like it's going.
So the starting question is, why is privacy such a big deal in bioethics? Why is it that it merits its own little separate place on the syllabus of a course like this one? What's the connection between privacy and bioethics? I'd just love to hear your thoughts about that as a starting point. Yes, sir.
Personal health is probably one of the more intrusive things that somebody could have to deal with, you know, within their family and such, things like that. So you would imagine that privacy is kind of necessary. It kind of goes hand in hand with like the medical profession and all the legal things that go with it.
Okay, so privacy goes hand in hand with the medical profession, but in what respects?
Like I said, it's one of the more intrusive things. You know, if you know you're sick or a family member's sick, so it would seem natural to maximize or minimize intrusiveness, kind of.
Okay, so that with the practice of medicine comes a principle or sort of a rule or expectation that we minimize privacy intrusions of all sorts.
Right.
All right, good.
Just, I guess, one example would be just personal records in a hospital setting, maybe, and who has access and who could gain access to them.
Issues of access to medical records? What's special about medical records?
Well, just the personal nature. You can have a whole lot about your physical self, if you will, in your hospital records, and a lot of people would find it damaging to have them get into the quote unquote wrong hands or a stranger's hands or something like that.
Okay, personal health is sensitive. Sensitive data is sensitive. What else? Yes.
I think of issues of discrimination, just either on the personal level, some people look a certain way at certain people with specific diseases. And that could affect your relationships, you know, a lot of the STDs or things like that. So if those got into the wrong hands on the personal level, that would be harmful. But also on the, insurance levels, if they have access to sensitive data, then you might be at the end of discriminatory practices in terms of, okay, I'm not going to insure you, something of that nature. It's going to definitely have a major impact on your ability to remain healthy.
Okay, good. Stigma, insurance issues affect health. We want so in general. I mean, discrimination, the information about health, sensitive data, personal health matters can result in discrimination, and privacy law, among other things, can perhaps help to ease the problem or address the problem of stigma and insurance based discrimination. Other reasons why? Yeah,
the medical importance of being candid, and so the need to assure patients that things will be kept private, so they'll disclose things about their economic situation, their sexual history, things that may not seem immediately medical but are maybe important to a doctor.
Incentives to candor. We believe that creating a context, a safe, confidential context of candor may in fact enhance health in two ways. One, it makes people more willing to go to the doctor and then more willing to share honest information about themselves when they're there. Yeah.
What about corruption or misuse if someone gets hold of your records and, you know, starts collecting your medication?
Right. There's a kind of identity theft is an emerging problem. People are actually going to the hospital pretending to be somebody else, both to get the pain medication, but also just to get care because they can't afford to get care otherwise. So it's a real issue, and privacy here really means like the security of personal identifiers such that people cannot get access to them and then use them without authorization. Yes?
Of informed consent.
What's the informed consent issue here? What's the tie between privacy and informed consent that makes privacy a big deal in the health context?
Because there's an overlap.
Overlap? Okay. I want you to flesh it out a little bit. Okay. I mean, because you see on the common rules slide, okay, there's an assumption that privacy is connected to informed consent.
Yeah. Well, informed consent has to do with getting permission from the parties concerned before using your personal information.
Okay, so informed consent is in a way all about that kind of privacy that we call decisional privacy, the right to make one's own decisions autonomously. Informed consent ensures that the things that happen to you within the medical context are going to be the things that you yourself have decided upon and chosen autonomously, have not been coerced or forced on you. Okay, so that has to do with autonomy. All right, all of these are, you know, you're all, you know, dead on. I'm sure you've had this conversation many times before, but I wanted to start off the before I begin to outline for you the structure of privacy law as it affects medicine, to make sure that we have a common sense of what's at stake here. What's at stake is information, which is extremely sensitive in the minds of most Americans. It's normative to think that health information is sensitive. It's personal, it's private. It's normative to think that the whole domain of health is one to which access should be limited and controlled and restricted. We worry about the consequences of access to health information and sick people. We worry about stigma, discrimination, and insurance, and both health and life insurance, by the way. We worry about people not being willing to go to the doctor and talk about their health issues candidly unless they're promised confidentiality and privacy. We worry about the lack of security of health data because it could be stolen and misused and abused by unauthorized persons. And we worry about whether or not the medical treatments, research, and so forth, are freely chosen. And so we worry about the decisional privacy of health interactions, and therefore we worry about informed consent. Okay? So that's the kind of the picture in the background. Now I want to talk with you about the legal terrain. So slide number one. Clearly, we mean a lot of different things by privacy, and I find it very unhelpful to try to give a definition of privacy, but quite helpful to think about the many senses of privacy that are in fact at play in American, not only legal culture, but in American culture generally. And let me just give you this list that I always use in my teaching and in my talks about the different kinds of privacy that are out there. And as you'll see, every single one of them relates or can relate potentially to healthcare and health research. So, overview, I mean, I think that you could sort of say, well, generally, privacy has something to do with access to people, publication, sharing of information, control over information, and choices about information. But I think a more elegant way to put that point is to say there are really six different senses of privacy that we care about. Okay, we care about physical privacy. Right. And the first case that we're going to talk about today, it involves physical privacy. Who gets to go into the room when the patient's dying? Can you photograph a dying patient? Right. So physical privacy, access to the patient. Informational privacy, access to data and confidentiality of data. Decisional privacy, who gets to make intimate choices? Who gets to decide? You talked about Roe versus Wade last time, reproductive health last time, a lot of decisional privacy issues. Who gets to decide, make important decisions about abortion, contraception, fertility treatments, and so on. Proprietary privacy. This is the notion of our having some stake in controlling the attributes of personal identity, whether that's our DNA or a cell line taken from our cell line taken from our bodies, but there's a sense within healthcare that we should have a privacy right, a privacy interest in controlling attributes of our identity. Associational privacy: who gets to be included, who gets to be excluded? What role do notions of family and of community have in how we grant people access to information and people? And then finally, intellectual privacy: the notion that our thoughts, our ideas, our communication should be protected by privacy norms. It's an idea that sort of the content of our minds is something over which we should have some prior claim. So you know, all of these are different notions of privacy. The philosophy, literature goes on for days in trying to define which is the most central or most important kind of privacy. Some scholars have argued that decisional privacy is really not privacy at all, it's really liberty. But I don't think it's necessary for us to take sides in that debate in order to understand where in the law the concept of privacy is doing work, and therefore what is the nature of our privacy law. So what we're really talking about here is where in the law is the concept of privacy doing work, whether or not it should be doing work there, where is it, and what work is it doing? All right, so think of it as three major areas or different types of law, and the next slide doesn't really list the three of them, but I'm going to give you the three, and then we'll come back to them in detail. But there's sort of three different parts of law. And those of you who are law students, this is like, you know, first day of law school, but if you're not a lawyer, you might not be accustomed to thinking about the law this way. But imagine sort of this is the domain of law. And there are different types of law within that domain. And one type of law in that domain is private law. And private law offers protection to privacy. And then we have, within that domain, constitutional law. And constitutional law, as you saw last week, offers protection to privacy, especially to decisional privacy. And then the final type of law in the domain is what might be thought of as statutory law and regulations. You know, laws passed by Congress or by state lawmakers. And then regulations that are issued pursuant to statutes. So the way I want the discussion today to flow is we're going to first start with looking at how does the private law protect privacy as it relates to healthcare and health research. Then how does constitutional law protect privacy as it relates to health and health research? And then finally, how do the various federal statutes and regulations protect privacy and as it relates to healthcare and health research? And I'm going to be about 95% about healthcare and maybe 5% about health research today. Because there's way more law governing healthcare than is governing health research. So now we come to the first category, the common law, the private law. All we mean by private law here in common law is we mean judge-made law that is a product of holdings by court that are themselves a product of private people like me and you bringing lawsuits against people that we think have wronged us. Okay? So then starting with the first case that I had you take a look at, the case of the estate of Bertha Hume. Did anybody have a chance to read that case and would like to tell us about the facts of the case? Yes?
I'll say I read it and I got confused with all the he's and she's about who was doing what.
Okay, all right.
So
what do you think is going on there?
The husband was dying.
The husband was dying.
It looked like the wife said, don't take a picture of him. The doctor did anyway. But there was a he-she switch that got me totally thrown off. Was that what happened?
Yes. So basically what happens is husband is dying in the hospital. Why is he dying?
Throat cancer?
Some kind of throat cancer. And he apparently had a very dramatic, large surgical wound that the doctor wanted to document with taking a picture of it. Mm-hmm. So the doctor, who's now finished with all the true medical care that he can possibly do. The man is terminal. He's imminently about to pass away. But the doctor wants, for his own sort of research and records, to take a picture of the man's surgical wound. He goes into the hospital room, and he tells the wife, and the wife says, actually, you know, he doesn't want you to do that. How does the husband evidence his lack of willingness to be photographed, yes?
He clenched his fist and then tried to remove himself from the frame.
Yes, he made some effort, you know, to get out, to not be photographed, but yet the doctor went ahead and did it anyway. And it wasn't just that the doctor, like, walked in the room and snapped a picture. What did the doctor do that one might regard as highly intrusive beyond coming to the room when he had no longer had any medical care to offer the patient? What did he do? Yeah.
Put a towel behind the guy's head for contrast?
Yes, he adjusted the body, put the towel back there, you know. And so he really, over the patient's objection, over the patient's spouse's objection, set the man up for the ideal photograph and took the photograph, right? And then the wife, after his death, brings the lawsuit claiming invasion of privacy, okay? And one important category of invasion of privacy is intrusion upon seclusion. And the classic example of this would be, you know, you're in your house, and someone opens your front door and comes in. That's an intrusion upon your seclusion. A little bit worse, you're at your house, someone comes up to your window and takes a photograph of you getting out of the shower. Intrusion upon seclusion. This is the same kind of a thing. It's an intentional entry into a private area in a highly offensive manner. Okay, and what the courts look for is this highly offensive intrusion. Some intrusions may be annoying, but not highly offensive. It's the highly offensive ones that get you victory in a lawsuit. So you're looking for an intentional, highly offensive intrusion. And the question is that such a thing? All right. Mm-hmm. But what makes this a hard case? I want to ask our doctor. What might make this, I mean, what if you're the doctor, you want to defend the doctor, How could you construe this as something other than a highly offensive wrongful intrusion?
I'm going to go with highly offensive, but
if pushed.
I would imagine that maybe he's an educator and he might say, you know what, this is an unusual presentation. I think that my responsibility to students everywhere is that I document this because everybody can learn, and who knows, maybe somebody else's care might be made better from the knowledge that we're going to gain from this.
And sure, there must be an exception in the law, a privilege in the law for doctors doing health research or health education, right? So, and I think you're exactly right in thinking about the kind of thing the doctor would have said here, because he did in fact see those kinds of things, that I'm an educator, I'm a researcher, this is gonna be good for society, for me to be able to go in there and take these pictures. I know it was not pleasant for the patient, but little is pleasant for a dying man, right? So that's the kind of, so I think the doctor was hoping that the court would be swayed by that kind of thinking and say, well, okay, you know, this is an excused intrusion, much as, you know, if a building's, you know, if this building were to start exploding and, you know, catching fire and exploding, there'd be tons of reporters in here taking pictures. Well, you know, they're privileged by the importance of the news to photograph even private, let alone public, disasters. So similarly, the doctor would say, well, I have an excuse here, or a privilege. I'm allowed to take these pictures because it's for research or education. Yeah.
Well, I'm just wondering what, from a medical perspective, obviously photos during surgery could show someone what to expect once you have a body open that you might not know. But like after surgery, and it didn't help enough to save his life, what would be the purpose of taking a picture of a wound?
Well, I mean, that's going to be, I'm not a surgeon. I would imagine if there was a complication from that. So I don't know why was he dying just from the throat cancer, or did he have a post-op infection or something like that? So I think it would depend on what the particular medical situation
maybe
was.
He used a unique closure technique and he wanted to document it, right? I mean, I could imagine that something like that, there's something atypical about this person's surgical wound that made it, you know, noteworthy in the doctor's mind. He wanted to record it, yeah.
Does the medium of recording whatever he wanted to do for educational purposes matter?
Does it matter?
For example, say he was a great sketch artist. What's stopping him from removing the name but trying to do some sort of detailed drawing of what he was trying to convey, if, say, there was some sort of, like, scabbing or infection that he wanted to try and document? Why would there be anything wrong with him leaving the room a week later, changing the name, perhaps, and then just keeping the facts the same?
Stephanie? So you're the wife, right?
Okay.
Doctor comes out with a sketch pad.
No,
hi there,
not,
Mrs. Bergenium.
No, not in the room. I mean,
oh,
like,
okay.
What's stopping him a week later
from
taking this specific case and that specific problem or infection or whatever it was that he was trying to educate others about, and then documenting it in some other fashion other than by just have taken a photo?
Well, that's a separate question as to whether or not there'd be any privacy problem with that.
That's what I mean, is that?
Right. So you know, I mean, you've been to Grand Rounds, and doctors do all kinds of sort of after-the-fact a presentation of what they've seen, sometimes based on photographs, sometimes based just on words, sometimes based on drawings and charts, graphs. So that's a separate issue, and I'll get back to that in a second, but I really want to focus for a minute here on what kinds of things should the family and the dying man be able to say cannot go in that room without their consent. Yes?
I mean, in medical school, normally you're taught from day one.
Yes.
To respect the body. You know, even
yeah.
after dissections, they
yeah.
still do a funeral for
yeah.
For the cadaver. So
yeah.
it is wrong for you to just come in and take pictures without the consent of the next of kin.
Okay.
So.
And so, what kind of interest are we talking about here? What is it that's at stake here? We can say privacy, but what to go a little bit deeper, what's underneath that? Yeah?
Yeah, I think it goes
respect?
To respect of the
yeah.
personhood of the patient and you know, this kind of decision making autonomy.
Yeah. Unless the person is signed some sort of
because I think when we think about privacy, a lot of times it has to do with how close an intrusion gets to kind of our personal moments or things that we consider to be shared only with ourselves or with
mm-hmm.
people very
mm-hmm.
close to us that we've
mm-hmm.
chosen to share with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I frankly cannot make sense of this case unless I go to notions like decency and dignity, because that's really what's at stake here. It's not about so much about the information flowing to other people. It's about at such a time one wants to be surrounded by one's loved ones, One wants to no longer be an object of the medical gaze. One wants to be, in those final moments, capable of experiencing dignity and also intimacy, right? Because I'm with my wife. They may have, you know, things to say to one another, final thoughts and words and sharing that they can't share if there's a doctor in the room. Imagine, you know, the kind of things which people sometimes say as their final words to their loved ones. Having a doctor in the room when that's happening just may mean that you lose that opportunity forever. You can't get it back. Yeah.
But also, in the same respect, in the past 50 to 75 years, the way we die has changed dramatically.
It's true.
And so in giving up the right to be in our homes and die in our homes, we are also trading
excellent
up for
point.
Extreme care.
Right.
So it's like, what, you can't have it both ways always. But
okay.
I understand that you're
all right. Great. Wait. And in that regard, I mentioned the next case, the Knight versus Penobscot Bay case, which is about a woman who brings a private lawsuit against a hospital and others because a doctor gave permission to the husband of a nurse to watch her have a baby. Okay, now, you may say, once we stop having babies in our homes, now we're in a hospital, and anybody who wants to, it just comes with the territory, right? So I raised the case because you raised the point. Now, we take that point to its extreme. I mean, so we've given up on, in modern medicine, the idea of dying at home, having babies at home, having doctor come to our houses to treat our colds and flu. Does that mean we give up all our privacy interest? Yes?
How is this kind of, these examples, how are they related to, like, voyeurism? Because if you can't take a picture of someone in their house coming
right.
out of the shower, why can you go look at them giving birth or, you know, lying in on their deathbed?
It's a it's a curious thing. Why would the doctor think that he should even ask even if the doctor asked the pregnant woman, would you mind? Even that's a little bit, to me, intrusive. Well, making someone at such a time answer that question, it seems indecent and lacking in respect. Like, why would you ask me that? The nurse's husband's bored.
Yeah.
Yes?
And not coming from a law background, I think about patient autonomy a lot.
Yeah.
So that's why the first case doesn't make any sense to me, because we have that drilled into us. Like, I can't even perform a life-saving maneuver if they say no.
Right.
Why would this person, if they clearly said no, why would you take a picture? You know what I mean? Like,
yes, good.
I don't understand. That doesn't speak to me because of this autonomy thing. And I don't know where autonomy, I know it's like an ethical principle that we talk about in medicine a lot. How does that fit into law?
So in the context of tort law, they don't use this phrase hardly at all. The words you're going to see are highly offensive and just invasion of privacy. You will occasionally see the word intimacy, you will occasionally see the word dignity, but the word autonomy has its home more in constitutional discourse than in private law discourse. Some scholars, though, trying to make sense of this area of tort law, say, you know, this is all about civility norms. This is a Robert Post concept. He's a professor at Yale Law School, civility norms. Civility norms, norms of appropriateness. These are what the law is trying to reinforce by allowing private lawsuits for invasion of privacy in cases like this. What I want to leave you with on this point here is that the common law, the common law, private common law, protects medical privacy, here meaning the physical privacy and associational privacy, by giving people a right to sue when others have intruded upon their seclusion in ways which are violative of norms of offensiveness, appropriateness, civility, dignity, and so forth. Okay? Just an example. I could give you others, but this is just one example. Yeah.
I didn't catch this in the case. Was the picture identifiable or not? Like, was his face in the picture, or was it just...
And, you know, we didn't even get there, because the lawsuit is not about something else, which is also tortious. This would be publication of private fact. I mean, you know, clearly it was a whole other issue. If having taken the picture, you know, now doctor publishes it in a medical journal or in a medical newsletter with the patient's name on it, we have a separate kind of issue, right? A publication of a private fact. That's highly offensive publications of a private fact, which are not privileged by some newsworthy privilege or some other privilege, would also be actionable in tort law. So you can claim he intruded on my seclusion, and he then published a private fact at me. I want to sue him both those two, under both those two torts. Yes.
Well, I was going to say that for people, but non-medical people, they don't. They may assume that it's only the face that means a lot, but you know, we're taught that regardless of what body part it is, even
yes.
when the body comes to the very, very minute pieces,
yes.
you have to take those pieces and you have to, you know, pack them well and you know, put them where they're supposed to be, and you still have to conduct an ethical service for those parts.
You know, because people are a little bit, you know, I'd say almost a little bit too extreme in the United States about
yeah.
scraping up every little bit of DNA off the ground, right, and burying it. So I have a friend, actually he's not a close friend, but a professional friend, Ken Feinberg. He's the lawyer who handled the BP compensation fund. He's a lawyer who handled the 9/11 compensation fund. And he told me once how he'd be in a room like this one, and in would come the families of the victims of 9/11, and he'd say, I can offer you, Mrs. Jones, $2 million for the loss of your husband, the firefighter. And she'd say, and she'd be unhappy. Not about the money, he would say, because she'd say, well, can you get me my husband's remains? And they'd say, well, you know, landfill, Staten Island, and people would be completely incensed that they believe the government had to do more to give them some little part of their loved one to bury. We were very obsessed with those little tiny parts. We think that somehow we're wrong if we don't have control over that too, even when it's clearly, you know, inconceivable and impossible to get that back. So yes, you're absolutely right about pointing it out. It's tied to this, the sort of great reverence that people have for the body. It's not just the face, although that's clearly the most, you know, if the person can be identified from the photograph, that makes it, I think, in most people's mind, more highly offensive than it would be if it's just, you know, a little bit of their kneecap or, you know, the inside of their muscle fibers, muscle tissue or something of that nature. All right, so common law. And the childbirth case for me is interesting because actually the very, very first published U.S. common law case about privacy had to do with childbirth. It had to do with a case back in the 1800s, 1890-ish, when a woman in Michigan was giving birth in her own home, and the doctor, this rural doctor, came to her little tiny little house, smaller than this room, and he brought with him another man to carry his lantern and his medical bag because he was really tired and he was old and everything, dark and stormy night. And the family assumed that the guy who was brought along to carry the bag and the lantern had to be a medical person because, like, why would you bring a young, unmarried, non-professional man into somebody's home at such a time? It was a huge insult to the family's dignity and their reputation as well. Because for a married woman to be seen, to have her, you know, her vaginal region seen by, or even potentially seen by, a man to whom she's not married, made her something of a slut, right? I mean, it undermined her modesty and her dignity in the community that someone who was not a medical person saw her at such a time. And this Penobscot case really is a wholly different era, but it kind of reflects that notion that childbirth, like dying, is a context of privacy. And I emphasize these two cases because as you know from your experience, the vast majority of conversations about healthcare privacy begin with what? What are you talking about? The vast majority of conversations about healthcare privacy are dealing with what? What?
What is the question?
The vast majority of conversations about healthcare privacy deal with what?
With HIPAA?
HIPAA? And what does HIPAA deal with?
Privacy.
But what kind of privacy? What kind of privacy does HIPAA deal
health
with?
Health information.
Health information. The vast majority of conversations about privacy in healthcare are conversations about data, about information. Okay. So my pet peeve is that, because I think that a prior conversation we need to have is about the body and who has access to it. So it's who gets to come into the room while I'm dying? Who gets to attend my childbirth? When I go to the hospital to get my mammogram, do they give me a robe that really covers up my entire, you know, body, that protects my modesty interest in not being seen? will random medical students come wandering into my hospital room and pull off my gown and insist upon inspecting my hysterectomy scars? I mean, so these kinds of questions are questions about privacy that I actually get remarkably little attention from bioethicists. I've never understood that. Why do bioethicists go right to the information and skip over those more immediate issues that patients every day struggle with? Yeah.
Because they're doctors.
Because they're doctors. And so they don't even, like, what's the issue?
Well, it's a normal thing for them.
It's a normal thing.
It's the medical gaze. That's the norm that I think most bioethicists come from. Maybe not today, but certainly 20 years ago.
And the doctors are trained to be, you know, or at least to appear to be, sort of neutral, objective, uninvolved, uninterested in the body. But the patient is all about my boobs, all about my, it's my vagina, it's my, you know, my grotesque scar, right? People are very sensitive about their bodies, and it's just amazing to me that bioethicists have had so little to say about the ethics and bioethics of those, that sense of it's not just modesty, because modesty is a part of it, right, a big part of it, but it's not, it's also a sense of shame and a sense of control and a sense of dignity people want to have respect to their bodies when they have medical encounters. Yeah.
I was gonna say, I think it's also interesting in the childbirth case, because whereas you have kind of more of a universal sense that you're gonna have a lot of picture of people like taking photos of a neck wound or something like that.
Yeah.
Childbirth is actually something that people are run a huge gamut of, you know, wanting to actually have it on film, which I confess personally confuses the hell out of me. Oh my God. But I mean, there are people who really value that experience.
I'm glad you raised this, because...
And yet, I can totally understand how that does not apply to a doctor giving permission to essentially this random third party to start videotaping. And I've been reading where some hospitals are now taking it on themselves to outlaw any kind of filming, even if it's the patient's husband or partner who wants to film the childbirth.
And it's liability-driven, right? They're afraid that if you document it, then the malpractice suit can say, we allege that malpractice occurred, we can show you the moment when the doctor inappropriately applied those forceps and crushed that poor little baby's head. You can imagine, right? It's like vivid evidence of improper... now, of course, it could also provide evidence to defend the doctor, but I think that the medical profession is more concerned about people being able to give what will be interpreted by a jury as evidence of malpractice, because juries, of course, are going to be very, you know, sympathetic to the poor mother and her
until
baby.
Until they show me, you know, a video of childbirth and then not guilty.
But notice how completely culturally loaded the conversation has to be about privacy here. And what you pointed out and reminded me is the change in norm. So, you know, 20 years ago, it would have been unthinkable that you would make a video of your childbirth. But it's almost like routine now. Nowadays, almost everybody videos their childbirth. Mom's in the room, grandmother, you know, dad, the brothers and sisters, little, you know, everybody come, let's see mommy have a baby. And then not only that, but on the internet, people webcast their childbirths. It's not uncommon.
What?
Excuse me?
Really?
Okay. You can see, you know, webcast childbirth. You can see webcast mastectomies. You can, you know, go on. It's all there. And it has a very nice educational purpose behind it. People say, well, you know, I want other women to know what it's like to have a mastectomy, know what it's like to have a hysterectomy, to have a child. And I think it is very empowering, actually, for women to be able to see these medical procedures and to see these natural procedures. At the same time, it represents a shift in cultural norms to have this happen. Now, I'm old, so when I was a graduate student back in the 70s, there was this sort of our bodies, ourselves, little hippie kind of girl movement, where if you went to the student health service at the University of Michigan, you'd be asked, do you mind if one of your peers watched you get your pelvic exam? And you're supposed to say, not at all, because we're all sisters, right? And so it was very common in those days for, but it was a political feminist thing, right? To let a strange peer, watch you have your pap smear. And it was a way of demystifying the body, of creating a sense of common interest among women. But that kind of died away in the 80s and 90s, but it's kind of come back now, but in a slightly different form. Now, not about political empowerment or feminism, it's still just about we just life lovers. We just document everything, right? It's just part of, you know. And we're no longer embarrassed or ashamed, which is a good thing, but it's a cultural shift. So now, is it highly offensive if the nurse's husband watches in a world in which, you know, mom might decide to webcast her childbirth anyway? Now do we care? So we'll take into account, the law will take into account in interpreting highly offensive the texture of culture and how cultural norms may be affecting people's behavior and their acceptance of behavior. Yes?
My mom is an OBGYN, and on a number of occasions she's asked patients if they were okay with me coming in to watch because I was really interested. And I did. I've seen like 7 deliveries, and but she only would feel comfortable asking if she knew the patient and was fairly sure that they'd say yes.
Yes.
Already.
Right.
She wouldn't just ask anyone. And I think that's how doctors think about it a lot of the time. It's on a much more like personal, individual level with this patient. Do they know me well enough? Do they know I respect them enough?
Mm-hmm.
And it's I don't think they're thinking about the larger ethical issues most of the time.
Well, what they're probably thinking also, and we all think this way, I think, but I would ask us to be self-critical. Well, if the patient consents, you know, but my concern here is being asked whether or not you consent, that they're being asked is something of an intrusion. It puts you on the spot, and saying no is a little bit difficult, right? But I've been in your situation. I've been on grand rounds, or not grand rounds, I've been on ordinary rounds with doctors just because I want to be educated. I went on rounds with a geriatric psychiatrist at Hopkins a few years ago. One of the most amazing experiences of my life, to watch this very expert neurologist, psychiatrist, examine these elderly patients. I saw a person who thought it was 1925. I mean, it was amazing to see people with these massive cognitive deficiencies and to see how they are cared for. But yet I felt like a voyeur. I felt a little bit unclean or inappropriate because I had, you know, my claim on being there was so tenuous, right?
Right.
And the doctor asked the patient, but, you know, do you mind if Dr. Allen, you know, observes me, examine you? What are they going to say? They're old, they're sick, they have dementia. You know, what are so it's that position that I think we have to work
on. Context is important because on almost all of them, there were other people in the room also. I was in one where there were like 10 family members in the room, including kids.
Yeah.
It was the norm.
The norm, yeah. So one more person, and now, so there's all the medical students, and then there's Dr. Allen. Well, you know, and so the patient's overwhelmed by this room full of people, and, you know, the more the merrier, question mark? All right, one more category here. So we have the intrusion, publication of private fact. We also have, though, quite apart from the privacy tort, a special breach of confidentiality tort. And I just gave you one thing to read, the Gap case, but I want to mention another one too, which is even more on point. But sometimes these are not about the Knight case and the estate case are not about confidentiality. They're about who gets physical access to people. It's about physical privacy. What about confidentiality? Well, unsurprisingly, private law, common law, also includes a breach of confidentiality tort, and if someone inappropriately breaches confidentiality, you can bring a private lawsuit against them. And the slide mentions two cases, Humphers and Gracie. Humphers and Gracie. Yath is also arguably a confidentiality breach case. I want to talk about that case in a minute, but let me just say something about Humphers, which I think I didn't give you, but it was a case about adoption where a doctor is approached by a young woman who wants to know who her birth mother is, and the doctor decides to concoct a fake story so that the adult adoptee can ask the state to unseal her adoption records to find out who her birth mother was. Well, adult adoptee finds out who her birth mother is, goes to birth mother. Birth mother, who's put this adoption aside for her whole life, adult life, is really upset and brings a lawsuit against the doctor. According to the court, the doctor has breached the confidentiality of the patient, namely the birth mother. All right, so that's a good example of breach of confidentiality. In the Gracie case, I love this case because you have a married couple, right?
Yeah.
And they're at war. Ah! Well, you know, the therapist thinks what?
How about if, yeah.
Oh, go ahead, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say that the therapist assumed that they were privy to each other's private information.
That they either were privy or that they should be privy, right? So the therapist tells the husband what the wife told him, the wife what the husband told him, thinking it's going to have therapeutic value. It pisses them off. They both sue the doctor, right, for breach of confidentiality.
All together after all.
And it's a very interesting case when you think, well, wait a minute. I mean, shouldn't the married couple be in privity of information, you know? And shouldn't we applaud the therapist for making a dramatic effort to get these two people back together again? He succeeded, right, in a way, ironically, right? But that's breach of confidentiality. Yeah.
Andrea, I had a quick question about a recent case about a certain Jesse Shipley, a 17-year-old kid who saw a friend spot his brain in a mortuary field trip. And then the parents ended up suing.
Wait, he saw his friend's
brain.
Okay,
yes,
sorry.
Well, this was a certain Jesse Shipley.
Okay.
17-year-old died in an accident.
Right.
And then his friends went to a museum, and there was a Staten Island Museum in New York.
Yes.
And they found his brain in a jar. And they ended up suing the medical examiner. So it's actually here. I was wondering how the case played out. I never
Please give me the citation of that case. Right, just write down the name of the okay. I haven't heard of it. It's an interesting case because yeah. families are very sensitive about that kind of thing. Maybe the most familiar case that I know of is a case in which a teenage girl was tragically killed in a car accident, and they were very, very gruesome, graphic crime—not accident scene pictures taken of her, with like her decapitated body laying on the sidewalk, all smashed. Everything was really grotesque, and some of the people involved in the medical, not the medical, that was more the police actually, the police guys, state troopers. They posted these images on the internet with her name, you know. And the family was absolutely horrified. I actually show these slides to my law students. I won't show them, I didn't bring them to you, but they're really horrible pictures. And the family claimed invasion of privacy, that to publicize. And the court's response was very interesting, because normally, if you're dead, you don't have any privacy interest. But the court said, well, actually, families of recently deceased people do have a privacy interest in not having the deceased, body on displayed or publicized to the general public.
And also, just because you're dead, it doesn't mean like anything that was you had. That doesn't mean everything that you had at one point in your life is gone. I mean, we have wills, you know. So like, there are certain things that go on after you die, you know.
Yeah.
That you can't just break because you're dead, you know.
Yes, that's absolutely true. But on the other hand, you know, if I'm killed in a tragic car accident today, and then tomorrow somebody publicizes, well, you know, Anita Allen was having an affair with, you know, her colleague at Penn. I'm dead. I have no more privacy interests, right? So some privacy interests clearly don't survive one's death. But the courts have made an exception. They say, but when you die, the only people who can protect your privacy is your family, and they get to assert the privacy interests which you and they share in you know the images of your dead body. And I guess the brain case by analogy would be sort of similar, where a part of the body is on public display with a name on it, people can see it. That's not respectful of the privacy of the deceased or the deceased family. All right, this chart I want to call your attention to here, because it's an interesting example of how data flows in a modern context involving both publication of private fact and a breach of confidentiality. So this is a case, a recent case from 2009, in which a patient named Yath goes to the Fairview Health Clinic, and that results, of course, in information flowing from Yath to the healthcare provider. That results in a medical record. I'm following the arrows on the chart. Medical record, a medical file. And first, one employee accesses the file out of just curiosity. And then the next employee accesses the file. What? She had an affair? She has an STD for having sex with someone, not her husband? So the case is about a STD contracted outside of marriage. Well, you know, employee one accesses the file and tells employee two. Employee two accesses the file and tells many other people. Somebody sets up a page on MySpace, you know? Yath had illicit affair and got STD, you know? Chlamydia, gonorrhea, whatever, you know, on the MySpace page. And then, of course, anybody on the web who had access to that MySpace webpage would then have been able to see the information. Question, is there a cause of action for publication of private fact? Put the word private in there, it's very important. Is there a cause of action for breach of confidentiality? Clearly, this would be a great case for a breach of confidentiality claim, because people who work in hospitals, employee one, employee two, are not supposed to access health records and then give information outside of that circle of confidentiality, right? So, you know, there's the doctor and the patient, they're in a confidential relationship. Well then, you know, if the doctor or anybody else lets data flow out of that confidential node into the broader network, that's a breach of confidentiality. That's a wrongful thing. The law recognizes this as a tort and enables the wounded, offended person to recover money damages. Okay? Yeah.
So I have a question. I know, or my understanding is, in attorney-client confidentiality, yes, if the client shares a fact or some information with a third party, it good. Kind of kills confidentiality for good.
Yeah, is not, that not true case? Of healthcare. No, because if, you know, I so suppose that this is not just any old patient, but it's Miss Yath, right, from the case, right? So maybe, you know, the day before, Yath told her book club, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody in the book club knows that Yath has got an STD, having an affair. Right? It's like 12 people, right? 12 people. It's still the case that if Yath goes to the doctor and tells the doctor, and the doctor tells the nurse, and the nurse tells the internet, that there's been a breach of confidentiality, even though other people know that fact. So in law, it's actually a great comparison. In law, we protect the confidences revealed in confidence, right? The confidences that are only known, that are a product of the attorney-client relationship, not just secrets in general. Here, we protect the confidences in that relationship, but we also protect information which is sensitive, which may have been shared with many, many people outside that relationship. And the point is that the nurses, the doctors, the staff have a professional obligation not to breach confidentiality, even if the information, that personal health information, PHI as we call it in the HIPAA world, right, is known to other people. Now, it may be the damages you recover are less because lots of people knew it. If you breach confidentiality, publish a private fact, but it's well known, right? That may mean that your damages are less. You get less money than you might have gotten if it was truly, you know, truly a secret. Okay. So this is just category one private law. Private people saying you breach your confidentiality, you publish private facts, you intrude upon my seclusion, medical context. I want money from you, and people often win these kind of lawsuits. I emphasize the Yath case just to show you how, in the age of the internet, the kinds of risk we're talking about from breaches of confidentiality are enormous, because it's not just that, you know, the whole town might know, the whole city might know, the whole world might know if it were a juicy enough story that kind of caught on, went viral, about a person's private health care information. And we have to be very careful as providers of health care that we don't let data flow in ways which might result in a truly prolific outpouring of data to inappropriate, unauthorized persons. Now, in this particular case, the plaintiff, yes, she actually lost her lawsuit against a number of these people because her complaint was about the MySpace page, and she sued people who had not themselves put up the MySpace page. And so for that part of it, the publication of private fact part, she actually lost, but she won the breach of confidentiality part of the case. That was a good claim that got to go forward to settlement or jury. Okay? All right. It's a lot. I know I'm going very fast. We have a lot to cover, and I have a little bit of time. I have to actually, we're going to end class about 6 o'clock, so I need to kind of keep us going at a fairly fast. That's common law. All right. Now, what about constitutional law? You've seen this already, because you talked about Roe v. Wade last week. Okay? Did you do Right to Die last week as well, in the life? Okay, so I can be very brief here. You know that our Constitution is interpreted to protect interest in decisional privacy. What I'll do is I'll say a little bit more about the many ways, many doctrines through which medically related privacy could potentially be protected. So I'm going to go here. So the Constitution, as you know, is a very slim document, but it has, as part of it, a Bill of Rights and couple dozen amendments. And it's the Bill of Rights and the several dozen amendments that we care about when it comes to privacy rights, because privacy rights are protected through the First Amendment, the Third Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the Ninth Amendment, the 14th Amendment, primarily. And if you look, if you read Roe versus Wade or the Right to Die cases, Cruzan, or the assisted suicide cases, Vacco and Quill, or Washington Glucksberg, you're in the domain of the 14th Amendment. And here, the issue is the extent to which substantive liberties are interfered with by the state. Can the state interfere with our choices regarding hiring a physician to end our lives, regarding authorizing our loved ones to have doctors to pull the plug on hydration, nutrition, respiration, or can the state force us to have babies, i.e. to not be allowed to abort? Can the government say we can't use birth control as it once did in the 1960s? These are 14th Amendment issues litigated as questions of to what extent can our liberty that's guaranteed by the 14th Amendment be interfered with by government, okay? But it's important to know that this is not the only area of constitutional law where privacy doctrines are an important part, and they relate also to healthcare. I just mentioned a couple under the context of the Fourth and Fifth Amendment. Let me mention the Fifth Amendment first, which some of you may not have even thought about. But you know, the Fifth Amendment protects our interest in not incriminating ourselves, right? It's a right against compulsory self-incrimination. How does this relate to medicine? You're driving down the road, as Mr. Smerber was in a famous case, driving down the road, you're stopped by the police. Police suspects you of drunk driving, right? Can the police force you to undergo a blood test to see whether or not your blood alcohol level exceeds the legal limits, and then use that information to prosecute you for drunk driving? Now,
I thought that you could refuse,
which is an admission of guilt. And if you refuse, then you face the consequences of possibly just being prosecuted for drunk driving. And so, but you know. And in the actual case, I think that Mr. Smerber had it over the hospital for other reasons tied to the accident. And the police just simply asked the technician, you know, run a blood alcohol test as well. And then the question was, can that be, is that admissible in a prosecution for drunk driving? Answer: yes. And the court has held that a little tiny blood stick is not a huge search and seizure issue. It's not a huge incrimination issue, because you're not being asked the question, are you drunk? Answer: no, right? Suppose you were drunk. Are you drunk? You say, no. Yes. No. Well, okay. now you incriminate yourself, right? But if I just don't ask you at all, bring my hypodermic needle over here and just take the blood, right? And then I look at it. Then I know you're drunk whether you tell me or not. So the courts actually have held, and this is a little bit disturbing, that if you indirectly get information from people, it's not testimonial, there's no Fifth Amendment problem. And so the taking a blood test is a non-testimonial accessing of might say, health information. That's not unconstitutional. It's not an invalid search and seizure without a warrant. It can be appropriate, and it's also not a Fifth Amendment problem, because it's a minimal intrusion. It's a minimal intrusion that leads to non-testimonial incriminating evidence being gathered about you. You might ask, well, how far can we go with this idea? Can you take an AIDS test? How much testing can we put through? But repeatedly, the Supreme Court has held that peeing in a cup and getting stuck by a pin is not a big deal constitutionally. Those kinds of searches may not implicate the full sort of force of the Constitution. in the Fourth Amendment context, we've had cases about, you know, random drug testing. So can, you know, can the government ask its employees to undergo random blood and alcohol testing or random drug testing based on your analysis and blood test? Absolutely. Why? Because it's not a law enforcement thing. It's an administrative need to make sure that our the people who drive our trains and who protect our borders are not on drugs. So we can ask them to undergo drug testing. And this is not any violation of a legitimate expectation of privacy, right? People do have legitimate expectations of privacy, but those are not offended by being asked to pee in a cup or have a blood stick if you have a certain kind of job with the government. So we have a whole area here of expectations of privacy, which come into play with warrantless searches and seizure. And even where the courts are holding that it would be ordinarily a warrantless search and seizure, the courts have also carved out huge domains in which it's okay to engage in blood and urine testing without a warrant and without any suspicion whatsoever. So school kids, for example, if schools want to make random drug tests a condition of being on the sports team or the chess club, Supreme Court says that's okay. Can you strip search a 12-year-old? Probably not. But you could definitely ask all the students in your high school who want to play sports or be on the cheerleading squad, on the chess team, to undergo a urine test. Why? Because of the public interest in keeping kids off of drugs and yada, yada, yada. Yeah.
With the warrantless search and seizure or like self-incrimination, is there any, like, this might have to do more with like common law, but say you're like in duress and you need a doctor, you don't like automatically forfeit all your rights because you're basically in a situation where you need medical help. You know what I mean? So could that like go with the Fifth Amendment kind of thing, or is that more like common law, like contracts under duress kind of thing?
Give me an example.
You were in a car accident and there was a doctor, and you know they for some reason he had access to your blood or something like that, and because you required a doctor, he, you know, has your blood now, but you didn't make any, you know, contract with him that wasn't under duress. So, like, now he has this information, whatever information you can get from this really weird situation. But, you know what I mean? Because that's kind of like self-incriminating yourself. But, you know what I mean?
So maybe you're in a car, so you don't really consent to your blood being taken, but it is
right.
Taken. Information which is incriminating, that may be evidence of a crime, is there. Does somehow the fact that you didn't give consent mean that the evidence can't be used? Answer, no, it does not. The Fourth and Fifth Amendment are interpreted, I mean, to put a positive spin on it, it's wonderful to have rights against self-incrimination. It's wonderful to have rights that against the police engaging in searches and seizures without a warrant. But I'm emphasizing at the moment there are so many exceptions that give the government the ability to, both for administrative reasons and for crime control reasons, to require testing of us, of our body fluids, without our consent, or to use the products of testing without our, that's been non-consensual, for its own purposes. And we have to really be vigilant as sort of, you know, freedom-loving citizens as to how far the courts will go in allowing this kind of activity to take place. And, you know, I think that it's, I'm perfectly happy myself personally with the idea that people who guard the borders, border guards, have to undergo random drug tests. Here you are, people who are, you know, keeping the drugs from South America out of Texas. Well, suppose they're all drug addicts. Well, you know, they may have, you want to have some way to make sure that people who have responsibility for keeping us safe actually are themselves not engaging in crime. But it's a little bit harder for me to accept that, you know, if I'm, you know, suspected of drunk driving, I can be forced to undergo a breathalyzer test or even a blood test in my situation against my will and have that used against me in a criminal proceeding. Okay? So beyond these grand 14th Amendment liberties that we talked about in Roe versus Wade and in the right to die cases, we have these other sort of healthcare interests in testing and evaluation, which are protected by the Fourth Amendment, but not absolutely. Okay? And the kind of issues we have in the first and third, I won't go into that because they're not really tied to healthcare, but here, the testing is huge and the autonomy and informed consent is huge under here. Under the test set, I make one particular emphasis here. I mean, when AIDS became first a big public health problem in the U.S., there's this mad rush to require testing. Every doctor should be tested, every nurse, everybody who works in a nursing home, and fortunately, within a few short years, the courts established that, you know, if concern about AIDS transmission cannot be so irrational that anybody who has any limited contact with a person who may have a risk of HIV should be tested mandatorily against their will, right? And so we have to see the courts using the idea of rights to expectations of privacy count against mandatory AIDS testing of people who happen to work, say, with retarded children or with dentists and doctors and so forth. Mandatory testing has limits. There can be mandatory testing, but it needs to be justified very closely by the particular kind of interactions that doctors and others have with people who are at risk of AIDS or people who might be at risk of contracting AIDS from the healthcare provider. What's the current practical norm around here as for who gets HIV testing in the medical profession? Everybody?
You mean people who are workers in the profession?
Yes.
The only time that you would have to do that is if a patient is exposed to your blood. Usually it's the other way around, actually, which mm-hmm. is the healthcare providers might be exposed to a patient's blood for some mm-hmm. reason. And then it's the same for both patients and physicians, which is respectfully go and ask them if you can test for, you know, Hep C and HIV, and if they say no, you test them anyway. but that doesn't make any distinction between healthcare providers.
And the conference is in the early days of HIV in the 80s, there was a school of thought which believed that you should just routinely, automatically test everyone in the healthcare profession to know baseline. And then, of course, if there's an incident, that gives you a reason to test patients as well, right? But there's a strong assumption that we needed to know up front who might have HIV and it was worth engaging in mandatory testing for that reason. But that mandatory testing implicates our constitutional liberties as well as our expectations of privacy, okay? Let me then just quickly move to the last category here of statutory law and regulation. Okay, so you've got your common law and constitutional. What about statutes? And you know, a lot of you know a lot about this domain because you know about HIPAA. So, and I can't possibly say enough about that today. I skipped a slide with the constitutional stuff on. I skipped the Eighth Amendment part. It's a little bit, if I have time, I might go back to that, but it's a little bit off the central point. A little bit more to minor kind of a constitutional privacy interest tied to healthcare. But in the realm of statutes, we have, of course, HIPAA and GINA. And what HIPAA did finally was to give us a federal healthcare law, because until HIPAA was passed less than 10 years ago, all we had as patients was this stuff. We just had our state common law rights, and maybe some state statutes that were implemented to kind of modify or expand the common law rights. We didn't have any federal protection. HIPAA, Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, its privacy and security rules work to protect personal health information and also to protect the security of how we transmit electronically healthcare information. It applies to certain kinds of entities, like hospitals, insurance companies, and so forth. HIPAA has one interesting feature of it that upsets some people, which is that there's no private right of action under HIPAA. If a doctor grotesquely violates your HIPAA rights, you can't sue him. You can complain to the Department of Health and Human Services, and that department can bring an appropriate enforcement action against your doctor or your doctor's hospital. But you yourself have none of these rights to access the courts that you have in a common law context. So under HIPAA, we have a close relationship between the Department of Health and Human Services and the profession, whereby the profession is monitored and sanctioned if it fails to offer its patients the protections that the statute maps out for it. It's a very complicated statute, but the bottom line here is that, you know, it protects our health privacy. I gave you to read some examples of HIPAA enforcement actions. It's kind of interesting to see what kinds of cases have arisen under HIPAA. I mean, everything from, you know, well, one of my kind of favorite examples is so in a way trivial. Pharmacy counter, the pharmacist has a list on the counter. You're supposed to sign the list when you get picking up your drugs. Well, if that list has the name of your medication and your name on it, it could be seen as a HIPAA violation. And so if you bring a HIPAA complaint against two DHHS saying, you know, Rite Aid in my neighborhood makes you sign a paper that has your name and your medication right there on the, it puts it on the counter, anyone can see it, then that's a HIPAA, that's a, you know, it's a trivial thing, but it's the kind of thing which HIPAA is supposed to do. It's supposed to make healthcare providers more sensitive to the healthcare information needs of patients. But, you know, there are HIPAA cases about things like, you know, calling the house and saying, leaving a message. The test came back. Mr. Jones has a melanoma. Who am I talking to? Mrs. Jones? Aunt Sue? You know, so that kind of thing leads to HIPAA complaints and has resulted in some. And the DHS is very, I think, kind. I mean, the sanctions are things like ordering training, additional training of the, you know, it's very, very educational. It's not you know, huge $1 million, billion. It's fine. It's mostly just, you know, change your practice. They could fine people, but it's mostly change your practice, do it better next time. It's a little hand slapping kind of thing. GINA is a great federal statute passed a couple of years ago. Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. GINA is closely tied, in my mind, to a notorious case in which an employer, a railroad company, was systematically but surreptitiously testing its employees for genes associated with carpal tunnel syndrome. Right? So you think you're going in to be, you know, tested for, you know, I don't know, something, you know, something relatively innocuous, you know, like, I don't know, what do people test for in an employment setting? I don't know. But anyway, the company had asked its healthcare providers to please check out the patient's blood for this genetic marker. And it was really stupid anyway. But the point is that they were actually doing DNA testing of their employees. And that outrage, and when that came public, that outrage was one of the things which finally got it to GINA. Because GINA says that employers may not require DNA testing of employees. And it also says that healthcare companies, health insurers, not life insurers, but health insurers may not use genetic information to discriminate against patients. So GINA and HIPAA together, along with some less familiar, more recent laws like ERA, they work to create a domain in which, under federal law, patients know that their genetic information, their routine health information, will not be shared without their consent, except for certain minor routine purposes and certain exceptions for research. And they know that if they do have a problem, they can turn to an agency who will address the problem through primarily through education and light sanction. So it's a better world than it was before. I have lots of complaints about HIPAA. A lot of it's just ritual, you know. You know, sign here, sign your HIPAA form, sign here. You want to go to the ER, sign here. People have no idea what they're signing. People don't even know what HIPAA, most people think HIPAA must mean like Health Information Privacy Act, right? Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. Privacy appears nowhere in that word, but people have no. Anyway, so one of my complaints is that the law has led to a series of meaningless, empty rituals that patients go through. While I do think it's made the healthcare profession more sensitive and more accountable, it's also, though, I think, created a lot of useless paperwork and false security on the part of patients. And it's also this problem of like over-enforcement. You know, you'll see things like signs saying things like, do not discuss the patients in the waiting room. Well, you know, if I want to talk about my child in the waiting room to the person next to me, HIPAA doesn't tell me I can't discuss my child in the waiting room. It tells the doctors they're not supposed to disclose personal health information, but the hospitals act as if HIPAA applies to everybody, but it doesn't. It only applies to certain covered entities, and so they have to be, but such concern about going awry that HIPAA is used or interpreted in this very expansive way. All right. Last thing I want to mention is this common rule. We'll have some conversation after this. The common rule, which you probably know about, the common rule is a federal statute. It's like 46 Code of Federal Regulations, 45. But the common rule is a major federal statute that protects human subjects from research abuses. And among other things, this is the statute which requires IRBs. And the statute applies broadly, not just to federally funded research or federal research, but also it applies to anybody engaged in human subject research as far as the IRB requirement is concerned. IRBs, as you know, are institutional review boards, which are impaneled. They have a certain membership criterion under the statute, and these review boards will examine health research protocols and look at, among other things, whether or not the protocol embodies respect for the patient's privacy and autonomy, in particular, the patient's autonomy in the informed consent context, right? Informed consent. And I think, my experience with IRBs, I've been on a couple of IRBs, is that they almost always focus on the informed consent issue, the decisional privacy issue, and on the data protection issues, and almost never on the sort of squishier, softer sort of intrusion type issues. Well, will the patients be walking around naked without their robes on too long in this experiment? But basically, it's a statute which has tremendously improved the protection of privacy, I think, in U.S. research by requiring informed consent and data protection, and increasingly even security measures to protect data from unauthorized disclosure. That's the federal scene. So, bottom line here, an amazing amount of privacy law tied to healthcare, private law, constitutional law, statutory law, working together to enable people who seek health care to feel, I think, relatively content. Of course, this area of law primarily works by providing incentives, right, to do the right thing, because if you don't do the right things, you might get sued. It doesn't necessarily prevent the bad things from happening, but it certainly does give everyone who knows the law an incentive to try to be mindful of your rights against intrusion and publication of private fact and breach of confidentiality. Constitutional law is like a beacon to protect autonomy primarily, but also some physical privacy interest through this idea of expectations of privacy, and the statutes just enumerate rights, mostly to information protection that we have in the context of, again, of healthcare and also of health research. So I'm going to sit down and give you some time to maybe ask any questions or to raise any concerns that you had from the reading.
I like the way you broke it out, just because I'm like totally a non-lawyer. Separate are those three categories? I mean, if you were to file a suit, could you file it on grounds involving all three? Or
it's a great question. Okay, they're quite separate. Okay, so to give a concrete example, the vast majority of lawsuits of this type, private lawsuits, are brought in state courts. Okay? And unless the parties live in different states, it's state court. If there's no constitutional issue, it has to be in state court. It can't be in federal court unless the people live in different states and are kind of, it's called diversity, when the parties have diverse residences. So one kind of separateness is that some health-related privacy lawsuits will be purely matters of state law and will be the lawsuits will be brought in state court. If your claim is the Constitution's being violated, you must be in federal court. Different building, different court, different judges, right? Talking about federal judges appointed by Congress, not about state court judges who are elected by you and me or who may be appointed by the governor. So it's a totally different sort of system of judges.
Yeah.
federal statutes, lawsuits that are based on federal statutes are brought in federal court as well. So one huge line is, who has the competence to hear the complaints? Well, if there's a dispute, it's, you know, state court versus federal court. Now, this is an oversimplification because although for the most part state court claims are heard in state courts, you can have what is called pendent state claims tried in the federal court. If a person's primarily basing their claim on a federal statute or constitution, they could be in federal court, but the court can also sometimes hear a state claim also in that context. Right. So it's very, it can be very, very different. So it's not like one-stop shopping. You have to make a choice as a plaintiff. What am I looking for? If you want money, right, you better be up here. Yeah. If you want evidence to be suppressed of a crime, you're down here. If you want an agency to behave differently next time, you're going to be down here in federal court. Private suit, money for private individuals. Here the remedies are criminal evidence suppression or a sanctioning of an agency. Occasionally you can get money damages in some federal lawsuits, but the way the health law is shaking out so far, for the most part we're talking about non-rights of private action, but rather incentives being created by the law to guide the profession in a certain direction. Yeah.
Are there differences for children in state law and privacy law or private law? I'm just thinking in that example you had with the children being tested at their schools.
Yes.
I feel like if you had like a 12-year-old child, it would be very different than the athlete on the varsity team.
Right, but it's the same constitution, right? So yeah. So you have the 14th Amendment. The Fourth Amendment in a search and seizure. The Fourth Amendment question being raised. The very same question can be raised about a 12-year-old in middle school or a college athlete or even a professional athlete, right? Although, let's put that aside because we're talking about state action, it's a public school or public university. But what, older kid, younger kid, same constitution. But what happens is that when the petitioner is a child, the court will look at the extent to which the school has an obligation or an entitlement to guide, educate, nurture, monitor the child in a way which is age appropriate that might justify a more extensive invasion of privacy than would be justified in the case of an adult.
It just seems like it could be a really hard line to be at. Because couldn't you be in a neighborhood where there's high crime and more drug use and make the case that you can do drug testing in younger children?
And that in fact, yes, 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 right.
It's really bizarre.
But is it much different from the fact that in urban, hard scrabble urban neighborhoods, there are metal detectors at the door of the high school, but in the sweet suburban little, there's nothing like that. The courts have allowed schools to make particularized assessments of what their population is at risk for, and to then quote-unquote invade privacy based on those assessments.
Seems so bizarre with health information. Like metal detectors are different than having a urine test.
Yeah, the Supreme Court has been extremely generous with allowing schools to test kids because of the interest that schools have in preventing drug abuse and so forth. The test case was 2 years ago when the strip search case, a 12-year-old girl was suspected of harboring ibuprofen on her person, and so the school principal basically said, take your clothes off, and the girl was stripped down to her bra and panties, and then she had to shake out her panties. She had no ibuprofen on her person, but a classmate said she did. Well, she brought a lawsuit alleging unwarranted search and seizure without a warrant, and obviously her expectations of privacy were violated. And people thought, well, they've already found that you can test the chess club and the football team. Maybe they're going to find you can also open a girl's bra to see if she has aspirin in there. But they found in the past you can go into lockers, handbags, and check children's possessions. So the fear was that the court was going to say it's okay to strip search a girl, but the court did not say that. Instead, the court says, here's where we draw a line, right here, you know. So young girl, strip search, this is not justified on these kinds of facts, especially where one classmate accuses another of having a contraband medication. It's just, So, you know.
That's the part that gets me. Like, if they're saying she has crack on her person.
Yeah. Maybe, right?
In a place where this person has been accused before, et cetera.
Yes.
Like, ibuprofen, Advil. Yes. I mean, I know you can probably make something exciting out of that, but
right.
saying someone has a couple ibuprofen tablets on them just doesn't seem like cause for action.
It was really stunning that the health concerns of the school led them to go to that extent to see whether this child had it. And so one argument was, why don't you call her mother, right? Call her parents and say, you know, we suspect the child has contraband on her. Would you mind coming to pick her up and taking her home and checking it out? But to just sort of say, go in there, let the vice principal strip search you. I mean, that was so completely beyond the pale in my view. But it was a series. First the locker and the handbag, then the drug testing the athletes, then the drug testing the chess team, and then the strip searching the girl. But I must tell you, guys, high school boys love to hide drugs in their pubic area, right? Because of course they're not going to check that, are they? Yes, they will, right? And so in one of the problems that the lawyers had in the strip search case is that there's lots and lots of cases saying it's okay to force a guy with an unnaturally large bulge, you know, to bear it all, because guys in fact hide their little, you know, pot stashes down in their panties. I mean, they're not their panties. They're
depending on the guy, whole different issue.
Tiny whiteys, whatever you call. Right. So some lawyers were afraid the court would say, well, if you can make a guy, you know, pull down his tiny whiteys, you can also ask the girl to pull down her bra and her pants. But the difference there was that there was no tangible physical evidence that she had the ibuprofen on her, whereas in these boy strip search cases, there's something a little bit, you know, unnatural about the appearance of a boy that's led the school to check into the underwear. Yes.
Okay, I personally feel that the school overstepped, you know, the boundaries.
Yeah.
Now, first of all, when I was 12 years old, I had to carry medication because I had a health condition when I was 12 years old.
Yeah.
Now, ibuprofen is not a controlled substance. So why would they, just like, based on what we said earlier. So, I mean, even if she had ibuprofen, I mean, I think that's how I would be more.
So it's not a federally controlled substance like Ritalin, right?
It's not schedule one or schedule two.
Right, but the point is that schools have an interest in not having medications that could be abused or misused in the building. And I think most high schools, now that I'm aware of, have very strict rules about medications, even non-prescription medications in the schools. And the students are told this, they know this. If you need to take medication, the nurse can administer it to you in accordance with the doctor's instructions and your parents' consent, and that's the way it's handled. But people are not told they can't take medication at school.
Okay.
Half the population is on Adderall, right? So it's very common for kids to take medication at school, but take it in a certain controlled way, handled by the nurse. So this was not unusual in that ibuprofen was contraband. Was unusual was that the extent to which the school went to try to uncover whether or not the child had the medication on her person. Yeah.
Well, and actually having those policies, actually, I would think brings up a HIPAA type problem, because if you go to the nurse, I mean, I don't know if this
interesting.
Is common for guys, but if you're a girl and you go to the nurse and you have to get like medicine for cramps or something else that's like horribly embarrassing, especially when you're in middle school, you know, you go and you're basically, the nurse's room is one office. And
it's true.
What other
yeah.
students are there for, you know, some guy, you know, gets hurt in gym class and he ends up in the nurse's office, and then you have to go and get whatever medication, be it a prescription medication or you have a headache or whatever else, you know, you're basically there requesting medication in front of your classmates and
that's interesting.
Teachers, etc.
It's an excellent
not
point.
Really a health
yeah.
provider,
yeah.
so I don't know if they're covered under HIPAA rules.
And, you know, being one of the 14 kids who marched to the nurse's office during a lunch period, there's the Ritalin crowd going up to get their midday Ritalin. So that there are indirect ways in which health information can flow, and it can flow because you're in the office with the football team guy, or because people know that at a certain time, people who need certain kinds of medication go to the, so there's ways in which, and that's something which about which schools could be more careful. So yes, and in fact, students may think, I'd rather have my own little stash of Pamperin, right, than have to go to the nurse and ask her for it, because then it'll be embarrassing, and I can, you know, have my health information disclosed. Typical public schools are not covered entities for HIPAA purposes, although it could be. I mean, I could imagine that a licensed nurse or doctor who's affiliated with the public school could be a HIPAA covered entity, but I'm just not sure about that.
If you're a nurse, you would have to, right?
I mean, yeah.
Healthcare,
yeah,
provider anywhere, yeah, you would belong to that. But you're right. I mean, functionally, though, even if you're not telling, you're there.
It's, yeah, kind of a demonstration.
Right. Okay. So what are the? Oh, go ahead.
I was just gonna say. Yeah. I know, for example, my mom's a public school teacher, and so if she has a student who has epilepsy, for example, or some condition that she would need to know about as someone who's responsible for that kid during the day.
Yeah.
She's not, I don't know what, she never took a HIPAA certification,
uh-huh,
but she knows private health information about that student. I think the students are required to inform, or the school is required to inform the teachers about certain conditions.
Yes. I mean, this is very interesting because sometimes, the demands of classroom education and the demands of privacy are at war, right? Because teachers have to know about, say, mental health issues that affect a child. If the child has, early onset schizophrenia or early onset bipolar disorder or similar kinds of diagnoses, the teacher needs to know that in order to protect that child and also other children and to properly educate them. So the information cannot be kept in a little secret compartment. People have to know in order to do their job. Also, the child's accommodations have to be respected, and that means telling the teacher that certain students have ADHD or other kinds of problems that may affect their learning. So it's really hard to keep information strictly secret, but once you start to expand the community of people who have to know, then, you know, this is a major deal. I mean, this is one of my personal areas of research is mental health, and I am just stunned by the inability of family medical secrets to be kept secret. So just to give you, this is, well, I'll come in here, but imagine that you do have a child with, say, I know that pediatric bipolar is a controversial diagnosis recently, but during most of the 2000s, it was an accepted diagnosis. Of course, you've got a child with bipolar disorder, and the child has frequent attacks of rage and anger. That may lead to aggressive and violent behavior. And that child may need certain kinds of accommodations for learning. They may have trouble. They have a joint diagnosis of bipolar and ADHD, a very common diagnosis. Well, who has to know, right? Well, parents have to know, okay? And of course, extended family are gonna have to know. And who will know? Maybe the neighbors will know, because sometimes the family has to call the police to help them get the kid to the hospital, which means, of course, the local police know. And all the social workers know, right? And then, of course, the child's pediatric psychiatrist knows. And, of course, the child's psychiatrist, whom the child does therapy, knows, the pediatric psychologist. And, of course, the neuropsychologist who's done the neuropsych eval knows about the child's condition. And, of course, the school counselor has to know, because she has, sort of social work stuff in the school. Then, of course, when the family applies for Medicaid to cover all those expensive hospitalizations, now we have Medicaid knows. So the federal and state Medicaid authorities know all about the child's mental health condition, and all of their various claims specialists who have to process all the claims, they know. And then what about all those hospitals? If the child gets hospitalized with a horrible rage attack, needs to have medication adjustment, goes to the hospital, now the hospital knows, and all their employees, the doctors, the support staff know, the nurses, the social workers, right? And then, of course, and I forgot to mention old people in school, of course, the teacher knows, right? And the teacher's aide knows, and of course, then not just the teachers in the classroom, but all the teachers know, because they all have to know. Right? So in the end, I mean, there's a huge number of people, it almost makes a joke of the idea of privacy. Did I mention private insurer? Because, you know, you use Medicaid for the big stuff, the hospital place, but you use your private insurance for just the routine, you know, buying the medications and seeing the psychiatrist. Yeah.
And then the second they're like out for more than a week, everyone knows.
Exactly. So the neighbors know, you know, the peers know, right? The soccer team, right? Because the kid doesn't come to soccer practice for a week and a half. So it's just the whole community. And one of my concerns about all this is that no matter how good the private law and the common law and the statute law looks on paper, the reality of receiving medical care in this country, especially for children, is that a vast, large, overlapping world of people have to know and will know about your health conditions, which makes some of our more minor complaints about, oh, the nurse told her friend, look a bit ridiculous, right? Because it's not a deeply held secret anyway. And we can't do anything about this to make it better, right? All we can do is hope that everyone who has access to information will use it in a respectful and helpful way, as opposed to, you know, setting up a website on Facebook or announcing on Facebook, oh, Johnny is in the a Penn Pediatric Psychiatry. You hope so. We're really hoping people will adhere to these implicit civility norms, right, and not abuse their knowledge in ways which are harmful to us as patients. I actually teach an undergraduate ethics class in about 20 minutes, so I have to go. But I just thank you for listening, and I realize it's a lot for a short time. I thought I was going to have 3 hours originally, but thank you, Beth. But I hope you got a little bit of an overview. And I especially hope that you appreciate my effort to kind of take you out of the standard bioethics conversation about privacy and to kind of open it up a little bit to some different ways of thinking about it. Okay, so I'll see you.
How do you like
I love